My guest today is Dr. Bernice A. King, CEO of the King Center, founded by your mother, Coretta Scott King, and dedicated to the work of your father, the global peace icon, Dr. Martin Luther King. Thank you so much for joining us on France 24. 60 years ago, August 28, 1963, your father gave what became one of the most iconic speeches in history, I Have a Dream. Why do you think that speech struck such a chord with people throughout history?
Well, I think it speaks to the hopes and aspirations of humanity, you know, whatever country you live in. There's been challenges in every country around social justice, around, you know, peace. And, you know, when people, I guess, hear his voice, they, you know, because people are always looking for something to hold on to give them the fervor and the strength to continue to stand up and try to make the world a better place. And he appealed to that in people. So there are a lot of universal themes in there. Of course, dream is a word that we can relate to all over the world, imagination, you know. Even though he talked about us as children, you know, everybody has some next generation, whether it's a direct descendant or it's, in my case, a niece. And so you start thinking about what do you want the world to be like for your family. So he really gave this global vision of a world where we can coexist, you know, as a family, you know, as community, you know, in peace and justice and freedom and equality. And so I don't know of any person in this world who cannot relate to any of those themes.
That's absolutely true. But what's so interesting is I follow you on social media, and often you post about that time in the 60s when your father was killed, and you say many people assume that he was universally loved, but you say he wasn't loved, he was actually hated, saying things that people didn't necessarily want to hear. Why is it important for you to remind people about that?
Because, you know, as you move further and further away from that time period, and people who were a part of that movement are no longer here to tell the stories of what was going on, you can be led to believe that he was somebody that nobody could possibly dislike, hate, see as a threat, because he was only talking about things that anybody would want to see in their world. In the nation, in their nation, and in our world. And I want people to know the reality, the truth, that during the time that he was speaking, it was very unsafe to say some of the things, you know, he said, to work against some of the systems and structures that were in place, particularly in the South, you know, where it was by law, you know, black and white could not mix and blend together. Black people, you know, were subjected to secondary standards, in many ways not even seen as fully human. And many people who were in positions of power that wanted to keep it that way, and whenever you're trying to, you know, challenge power, you know, in any form or fashion, it becomes a threat, so to speak, when it really shouldn't be a threat, because we're not trying to displace, we're trying to, you know, include, expand, and allow opportunity for everyone to enjoy this, you know, the similar benefits, you know, and opportunities. And so, yeah, when there was a poll done, you know, I think it was somewhere around 1966, 67, where, you know, it stated, you know, that he was very hated here in America. At that time, he had spoken out against the war in Vietnam, too. And a lot of people, there were still people who supported that war, you know, several who did not. And they felt like, you know, he was now taking a stance in opposition to his government, the president that he worked with for so many years on civil rights issues. How dare, you know, you speak out against the government this way? So, the polls everywhere were like, we hate this man. And I think that's why he was, you know, gotten rid of in this nation.
Yeah, and he was then assassinated April 4th, 1968.
Yeah.
One of the most poignant photos after that death is a photo of you. You're just 5 years old. You're lying in your mom's lap during the funeral in Atlanta. If you could say something to that little girl today, what would you say?
I mean, this sounds pretty, you know, simplistic, is that, you know, you're going to be okay, you know? At that particular time, I don't remember everything, but I obviously was very confused by what had happened, because my mother was trying to help me understand he wouldn't be coming back. I wouldn't see him again or hear him. And so the confusion got greater because they played his voice at the funeral. So if you're telling me he won't be able to speak to me again and I'm hearing his voice, I'm looking for him. So, you know, I worried a lot, you know, about whether something could happen to my mom, you know, and obviously she lived to be 78. So, you know, I probably would tell her that, you know, everything will be okay. You will grow up to be a woman who understands the sacrifice of both of your parents and your responsibility to make the world a better place. Because my mother was always telling us that, you know, that my father was trying to make the world a better place for all people.
And you have in so many ways followed in your father's footsteps. You became an ordained minister. You preached at Ebenezer Church here in Atlanta. You spoke at the UN. You went to jail like your parents. What do you think today your father, if he was alive, would make of the state of race relations in the United States?
I think he would be deeply troubled and disturbed. Not surprised, though. It's not like it would have caught him off guard. He wrote about all of this. He wrote about the things that we would anticipate as we continue to move forward and trying to create what he called genuine equality, which was where you had, you know, equity, where people had their fair share, you know, in this global society and economy. And we know now when we look across the board, economically, blacks are still last. In every, you know, every category. So I think he would be disappointed to see that we haven't made substantial progress in terms of that. He would be disappointed and saddened by the rise of, you know, neo-Nazism and you know, the white nationalist and you know, all of the hate groups. He would be deeply disappointed, you know, that we still have not understand the dignity, worth, and value of the black person. So, yeah, surprised, because he left some very poignant things for us to do, but not shocked, because in our faith tradition, he was a prophetic man. He had foresight, you know. He may not have been able to see every literal thing, but he saw the essence of what was to come if we didn't make certain changes.
And he also named things back then that are still very prevalent today, like police violence, police brutality, like we see here in Atlanta. Is that the biggest challenge, one of the biggest challenges facing the black community today?
I don't think it's the biggest challenge. It's a serious problem, just as it was back then. What is the biggest problem is the power imbalance. There's this power dynamic where black people's, you know, are not seen as people worthy to be respected and given dignity and to have a true seat at the table, not invited to the table, but helping to build. What kind of community do we want? Let's start with everybody at the table at the beginning. When you're talking about the power of the state, which is exemplified by law enforcement, the heavy-handed approach that oftentimes leads to high incarceration rates in the black community. So it feeds into some of these issues because the suspicion is already there at the beginning, you know. And then you have these laws that are imbalanced. So back during the Clinton administration, you know, if you had crack cocaine, which was more popular in the black community versus powder cocaine that was popular in the white community, sentencing was higher for the crack cocaine versus the powder cocaine. So here you again have the heavy-handedness of the law. So the whole criminal justice system has, you know, been imbalanced and has created, you know, an unfairness that causes, you know, this inflation of things in our community that really should not be the case.
So making a lot of those changes requires activism. It
yes.
requires protest. But do you worry that people today are getting into a state of apathy? A lot of activists just say that they are tired of fighting. There was even a UN report recently that said the same thing. Are people tired in the Black community? Are they tired of fighting?
Yes, naturally so. People get tired of always having to fight for something, you know. But the reality is struggle is it's endemic to who we are as humanity. You know, because all over the world, people are constantly fighting for the freedom to participate in government, the freedom to peacefully coexist, and the freedom to prosper in life. That's global. In our community, it's been perpetual since we've been here. And it always seems as if we get the short end of the stick. You know, we're always aligning and supporting so many causes. But when it comes to those things that are important to the Black community, it's hard to get people to come alongside in a persistent, consistent manner. So that makes it tiring. But it's also tiring because we didn't really learn and still have not learned from the teachings, the nonviolent teachings for Martin Luther King. That's why the King Center exists. My mother wanted people to know that you saw demonstrations and protests, but Dr. King had a whole philosophy and methodology of social change that he employed. And so we have kind of codified that and institutionalized that and now have online for anybody across the world, and it's been translated into French. They can go online and learn about Martin Luther King Jr.'s nonviolence, what violence is, what nonviolence is, what conflict is versus violence, de-escalation, the principles of nonviolence, the steps of nonviolence, how they worked in the movement, how you can work them today. There's steps to nonviolence that people don't follow. That's part of the exhaustion because they're going directly to just the energy of the, you know, direct action, and the information gathering that they needed to do in the beginning could have saved some steps in the process and could have helped to inform what kind of direct action may be the most effective.
And that's work that you're continuing today as the CEO of the King Center. Dr. Bernice A. King, thank you so much for speaking to us on France 24.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for staying with us. Time now for Eye on Africa with me, Georgia Calvin-Smith.
All the latest in politics, economics, and the arts in Africa on France 24. Our journalists are in every region, every country, to report on the emergence of a continent of unparalleled riches. Bringing you Africa's stories on France 24.
Okay, thanks for joining us. See you again. Take care.
Liberté, égalité, actualité.